This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It was a horrifying week of widespread death.
Tonight, coronavirus cases over 2 million worldwide. In the U.S., the death toll now topping 32,000.
But it was in some ways an ordinary week in Donald Trump. His threat to send Congress packing.
I will exercise my constitutional authority to adjourn both chambers of Congress.
His claims of absolute power over the states.
When somebody's the president of the United States, the authority is total. And that's the way it's got to be.
His scapegoating of the World Health Organization for his own February inaction.
The delays the WHO experienced in declaring a public health emergency cost valuable time, tremendous amounts of time. More time was lost in the delay it took to get a team of international experts in to examine the outbreak, which we wanted to do, which they should have done.
His Friday tweets inciting protesters to, his word, liberate the blue states enforcing social distancing rules, and perhaps most predictably, spinning revisionist claims about his limited travel bans, which he says refute the charges of incompetence swirling around him.
I saved tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of lives by hooding.
All of this playing out live in his evening briefings before a press corps, which till now has been largely unable to penetrate the presidential fog before being insulted or raged at and then cut off.
What do you say the Americans were scared, though? I guess nearly 200 dead, 14,000 who are sick, millions, as you witness, who are scared right now. What do you say to Americans who are watching you right now who are scared?
I say that you're a terrible reporter. That's what I say.
Go ahead.
I think it's a very nasty question.
But then on Monday, something happened. CBS News correspondent Paula Reid managed a sustained barrage of questions about what the administration chose not to do for the entire month of February.
I said in January.
Your video has a complete gap.
On January 30th.
What did your administration do in February with the time that your travel ban botched?
A lot. What? A lot. And in fact, we'll give you a list. What we did, in fact, part of it was up there. We did a lot. Look. You know you're a fake. You know that. Your whole network, the way you cover it, is fake. And most of you, and not all of you, but the people are wise to you. That's why you have a lower approval rating than you've ever had before, times probably three.
McKay Coppins is staff writer at The Atlantic. He's been analyzing the pivot by the president to the latest revision of contemporaneous history. McKay, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Now, the last time you were on, a little over a month ago, you said that reality would assert itself, the truth would out, that you cannot spin your way out of a pandemic. How's that prediction looking right about now?
Well, in a way, I think it has happened in the sense that a month or so ago, the president and his right-wing media allies were still saying that the coronavirus was no big deal. The media was overreacting to it and Democrats were just playing politics with it. That was the narrative back then. Now we've reached a point where tens of thousands of Americans have been killed. Hundreds of thousands have gotten sick. It's effectively shut down the United States economy. So the president and his coalition have had to pivot their spin, come up with a new narrative.
One that makes what's going on now look like their victory.
Exactly. The new message coming out of the White House and the conservative media is that he was actually prophetic that, unlike the media and Democrats, he saw the threat on the horizon when nobody else did. It's essentially a narrative that is diametrically opposed to reality, but that hasn't stopped them from pushing it pretty aggressively.
The president's rhetoric hinges on his January 31st decision to limit flights from China. Here's what his chief media proxy, Sean Hannity, had to say about that.
The president's China and European travel ban, I predict, will go down as the single most consequential decision in history. That's not political.
So what really happened?
The president did make this decision as the severity of the outbreak in Wuhan was becoming clear in January, and he got some blowback for it. But if you talk to experts about what this decision amounted to, they will say, first of all, that this was not a travel ban, it was a travel restriction. There still was plenty of travel to and from the United States and China.
40,000 people, if I recall.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of skeptics, both on the right and the left, frankly, will say that this was essentially a token measure. While this travel restriction bought the United States time, that time was then squandered throughout February and early March. What this time should have been used to do was to implement a national testing infrastructure, to acquire necessary medical supplies, to basically brace the U.S. healthcare system for a flood of sick people. And instead, the president spent that time saying that this was no big deal, that that action that he had taken had effectively saved the country from an outbreak.
It's not just the president. In preparation for the November election, the Republican Party has been cultivating the same narrative about Trump action, about Democratic obstruction and media fear-mongering. There was a push poll in Texas.
Not just Texas, but I spoke to a woman in Texas who late last month said that she got this strange phone call from a woman asking if she could administer a poll about the press's coverage of the president. And she said yes, and she gave her answers. And then the voice went on to express frustration with the way that the media had been so unfair to President Trump. And this woman who I spoke to actually believed that she was talking to a live voice. It took her a little bit of time to realize that it was a robocall. When I looked into it, I found that this call had gone to 120,000 numbers at the end of March, right around the time that shelter-in-place orders were going into effect across the country, and that it actually came from the National Republican Congressional Committee.
There was also an attempt not just to overwhelm, but erase history. In your latest piece, you call it memory holing.
The Trump campaign has started to send cease and desist letters to local TV stations that air a specific attack ad from a liberal super PAC that highlights Trump's comment where he said that all the hype around the coronavirus was a hoax. You remember he said this at the end of February during a rally. The campaign's position is that the attack ad in question takes his comments out of context and that it's actually defamatory. You know, if you actually talk to fact checkers, they'll say it's a little bit more complicated. His comments weren't totally clear. In any case, the political purpose of this is clear, which is they are trying to force TV stations to remove an ad reminding people of this comment. And in general, they've been extremely aggressive about pushing back against any reporter who brings up this comment. In fact, after my story was published this week, the official pro-Trump super PAC, America First, went after me on Twitter, saying that this was the media performing revisionist history, that the media hadn't been taking the coronavirus seriously until mid-March, which is conveniently right around the time the president started to take it seriously.
Well, the NASDAQ is doing poorly, but we're definitely in a bull market for projection. I want to get back to the daily press briefings. On Monday, Trump did, in fact, do something, as he likes to say, never before seen in the history of the country, for the whole world, hanging on to the latest news from the COVID-19 front lines. He showed essentially a campaign video.
It was very strange. It began with this on-screen text that said, "The media minimized the risk from the start," and then proceeded to show a series of clips of people on CNN and other networks from January downplaying the likelihood that there would be a really serious coronavirus outbreak in the U.S.
We're concerned about the coronavirus because they're hearing a lot of news about it right now. But the reality is, comparing it to the flu, for example, it's not even close to being at that stage.
How worried should Americans be about coronavirus?
Coronavirus is not going to cause a major issue in the United States.
These were sort of cherry-picked clips, but this is essentially the culmination of weeks of propagandizing around this. Recall, this was at a briefing of the White House Coronavirus Task Force. These briefings are supposed to be providing information to the public about this ongoing public health crisis. And instead, it was turned into this almost Orwellian display of propaganda and revisionist history that is clearly aimed at benefiting him politically.
There has been plenty of discussion about how the press should deal with these briefings, with all the lies and misinformation and video shorts and so on. Are you satisfied with the status quo?
My personal preference would be to air portions of these briefings that are important and then intersperse them with fact-checking and reporting. Look, I think almost all of this is sort of beside the point, because the reality is, unless you had every media outlet in America link arms and decide not to air these briefings live, there's going to be a lot of people who watch them. I mean, the ratings for these briefings at times have rivaled The Bachelor. There are signs that these briefings are helping the president politically. I spoke to one Democratic strategist who told me that they tested the effects of these briefings and showed voters 90 seconds of one of them, and found that after voters saw 90 seconds of one of these briefings, Trump's performance in a general election matchup with Joe Biden improved by more than 2 points.
Some of us have loudly sought a sort of Spartacus moment in which, after Trump cuts off or insults a reporter for her question, the next reporter takes up the same question, and if no direct response again, the next reporter does the same until he is finally forced to provide a satisfactory reply. Now, maybe that's just fantasy, but in that back and forth we played earlier with CBS's Paula Reed, Trump seemed to be on his back foot. Likewise, on Monday, when CNN's Caitlin Collins pushed back on his assertion of absolute authority over the states.
You said when someone is president of the United States, their authority is total. That is not true.
You know what we're going to do? We're going to write up papers on this. It's not going to be necessary because the governors need us one way or the other.
And a moment later,
has any governor agreed that you have the authority to decide when their state
I haven't asked anybody. Because I don't, you know why? Because I don't have to. Go ahead, please.
But who told you the president has the total authority?
Enough.
McKay, could we be at an inflection point where the leverage shifts from the podium to the press pool?
The president is accessible now to the White House press corps in a way that he has not been for most of his presidency. Another thing that's happened is that because of social distancing measures implemented by the White House Correspondents Association, there are only a handful of reporters in the briefing room on any given day. Whereas in typical briefings, you have a lot of different reporters from a lot of different outlets competing for time, and they're trying to get their questions in. And that sometimes, I think, gets in the way of actually getting information out of the president or holding him accountable. I think now with this smaller group, it's much easier for the reporters to demand answers to questions. Now, one of the president's go-to tricks in these briefings is to try to turn them into fights about the media. When he doesn't like the tone of a question, he'll bark at reporters to rephrase the question in a more flattering way, or he'll say, "You're fake news," or "You're biased." The White House press corps is at its worst when it takes the bait and kind of starts to fight with him on those grounds. But what I think we've seen in the last few weeks is the press corps, for the most part, being very laser focused on questions about the government's response to this crisis, trying to get answers in a way that I think is really important.
In fact, there was one especially impressive moment in that Paula Reid exchange. It happened when Trump was showing a timeline graph of his administration's heroic actions, but Reid spotted a gap, you know, like the gap in the Nixon Oval Office tapes, but it wasn't an 18 and a half minute gap. It was a 30-day gap.
Yep. The line of questioning was all about February. Basically, you implemented this travel restriction at the end of January, and then in March, middle of March, you decided to implement travel restrictions from Europe and do a series of other things. But what about February? What about that lost month? And, you know, that was a really important question. And in fact, I think the single most important question in why our government was so ill-prepared for this virus. And he didn't have an answer for it, but his various tricks to evade that question didn't work. And she just kept pressing and pressing. And the more we can do that, the more we'll be able to get the answers that we need as we move forward.
One more thing, McKay. If you ask me, the president has seemed, even by his own standards, inarticulate. And maybe right on the edge of losing his equilibrium in front of millions of viewers, as he's widely reported to do often in his staff meetings. What do you think?
What I will say is that he has not faced a situation like this before in his entire political career. He has not been in a situation where there is a genuine crisis that he has to confront, not a political crisis, not even impeachment, which was more about his own political prospects than it was about life and death matters within the country. He has to take questions every day from reporters. I think it's a good thing, by the way, credit to him for being up there and taking these questions, but it's clearly getting to him. He constantly is lashing out at these reporters. I think it's taken on a more frenzied quality. Recently, the New York Times reported that President Trump, at the beginning of all of this, was seriously considering launching a White House talk radio show. He ultimately decided not to do that because he didn't want to compete with Rush Limbaugh, a friend of his. But I can't help but think that that helps us understand how he's treating these briefings, right? He ultimately doesn't want to go up there and answer tough questions from reporters. He wants to use these briefings as a platform to push campaign for re-election and advance these propagandistic narratives. That's what he's been trying to do with these White House briefings. And the more reporters kind of get in the way of that, the more frustrated he seems to become.
McKay, thank you.
Thank you.
McKay Coppins is a staff writer at The Atlantic and author of The Wilderness, a book about the battle over the future of the Republican Party.
There may have been no Spartacus moment here, but in Puerto Rico, the press and the public have linked arms against propaganda, remotely, of course. Our producer, Alana Casanova Burgess, alerted us to a protest in San Juan, Puerto Rico, on Wednesday.
In keeping with social distancing guidelines, dozens of car protesters assembled outside a government-funded, government-friendly TV station. They called it a protest drive-thru.
We are demanding the test. People need to get tested.
Tests and also transparency. Governor Wanda Vasquez had taken to hosting coronavirus briefings at the station, which are closed to outside reporters. The governor's staff insisted that they weren't press conferences, but rather informative special shows. Another station, Telemundo, said it's, quote, something not even President Trump would dare to do, and refused to broadcast them. In the meantime, there's also been socially distant protests of banging pots and pans out of windows. Puerto Rico is behind all 50 states for per capita testing. Protesters say the strict shelter-in-place order is insufficient if the government is botching the testing measures and not doing much of anything else. The urgent call, made from a safe distance, is for more action.
Meanwhile, shoulder-to-shoulder protests this week in Texas, Oklahoma, Ohio, and Michigan are calling for less.
Pressure mounting to reopen parts of the economy. At the Michigan State Capitol, protesters blasted a strict stay-at-home order, which includes interstate travel restrictions.
The protest, dubbed Operation Gridlock by its conservative organizers, was an attempt to shut down the shutdown, to pressure Democratic Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer to lift restrictions they say infringe on civil liberties. Frustrations cheered on by Fox's Tucker Carlson.
When the coronavirus hit Michigan in force last month, Whitmer had no clue what to do. So she responded with a mixture of comical ineptitude and a weird kind of arbitrary fascism. She banned the sale of carpets and paint and potted plants. She told people they couldn't fish or go to church or drive alone to their own homes. But at the same time, Whitmer kept liquor stores, weed shops, and lotto kiosks open. It was just a matter of time before the people suffering under this insanity said something about it.
Before COVID-19 went global, some of us here wondered whether it could set up an epistemological collision between Trumpian spin, it's nothing to worry about, I alone can handle it, and deadly reality. A crash that might create a space for a genuine national reckoning. We shouldn't have wondered, because we've been here many times before. Puerto Ricans, after Hurricane Maria, still feel the pain of a reckoning denied, with incompetent leaders, an unknown death count, economic stagnation, and an unknown end.
What lesson do we take from what happened in Puerto Rico?
Well, I think Puerto Rico was incredibly successful. Puerto Rico was actually our toughest one of all.
History shows that this administration adamantly denies the historical record when it doesn't serve, and as we heard from Coppins, is doing so with increasing transparency. There's no reason to stop until enough of the nation says, as the president has, enough, and moves together to deny the deniers.
Coming up, science is under attack. That's not new, but this time, it's epidemic modeling under fire. And most of us are still struggling with the lexicon.
This is On the Media.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.